Welcome to That Good Sports Super Bowl Hangover Edition. I'm Brandon Perna here with Will Keys. Super Bowl has been played. We're going to talk about the Super Bowl. A little bit of Broncos news. Well, big Broncos news that happened over the weekend with the Hall of Fame additions. And, I guess just kind of wallow in the misery that everybody feels after the – not only was the Super Bowl, I guess, kind of shitty for fans, but the outcome was one nobody wanted. We'll get into that. Edelman worth the MVP pick. Raiders, do they even have a home? And a couple new head coaches in the NFL and Zach Taylor and Brian Flores. So they call that a rundown, Will. I told people what we're going to talk about.
Oh, cool. Job.
Now
you guys know what we're going to talk about. Awesome. Okay, yeah, so big news from Saturday night before the horror that was the Super Bowl on Sunday. We actually had something good happen this week, and that was that Champ Bailey and Pat Bowlen. Bailey was on his first ballot, and Bowlen, it's been a long time coming, but they're both in the Hall of Fame. Steve Atwater and John Lynch, of course, didn't get in, but Champ Bailey and Pat Bowlen joined Kevin Mawai, Ty Law, Ed Reed, Johnny Robinson, Gil Brandt. I know I'm forgetting somebody. Does it matter? It does matter.
I think you got them all.
Maybe, yeah.
Champ, okay. Pat, Mawai, Brandt, Johnson. What's his name? Johnny Johnson?
Oh, Tony Gonzalez.
Oh, yeah, Tony. Tony! Yeah.
Tony Gonzalez, by the way, kind of going scorched earth on the Chiefs, their whole fan base. He's basically saying that, like, you know, his years in Kansas City were great, but, like, he, you know, the best years of his career were in Atlanta. Not that he did that much winning in Atlanta, but he did at least win one playoff game, which is one more than he did in his many years in Kansas City. So, I don't know. A lot of Chiefs fans turning on him, too, and saying that Travis Kelce is better, which I very much disagree with. But they have the right to their opinion.
Yeah, I mean, Tony Gonzalez was a great tight end. How many years did he have? He played most of his career in Kansas City. 12 years in Kansas City. Then 5 in Atlanta. That's a long career for a tight end, too. That's why you got all those records.
It's a very long career. Yeah.
And,
and the latter half of his career was – less like, you know, explosive tight end stuff and more just like being old and thick and like boxing dudes out in the end zone, which worked really well with Matt Ryan.
Yeah, I mean.
But it's kind of surprising to see him turn on the Chiefs like this.
No, it is. His last three seasons were 80 catches, 93 catches, 83 catches for 875, 930, 859 yards, and they were all 7 or 8 touchdown seasons. So
he was always good, you know?
Yeah, no, he – looking at his numbers, he was maybe one of the most consistent tight ends ever. Like after –
Yeah, I think he's – yeah, second in receptions all time to Jerry Rice, which is absurd thinking about a tight end. You know, 100-yard or 100-catch seasons are – very unusual for tight ends. And Tony Gonzalez, I don't know if it was a matter of not having very many options in Kansas City or very frequently having bad quarterbacks that checked down to Tony Gonzalez as a security blanket a lot, but the man had numbers.
Yeah.
And by the way, he played basketball.
Yeah, and he played basketball. All of his 1,000-yard seasons were in Kansas City. He had 4 that went over 1,000. I just remember being like very happy when he went to Atlanta, so the Broncos didn't have to play against him anymore.
Yeah,
and he was always like a safe fantasy football bet too. Nobody ever would take him. He was always available. Then you pick him up and you're like, oh shit! Every week he's got, you know, 6 or 7 catches, 70 or 80 yards, and then you sprinkle in that touchdown here and there, and that's Really, I mostly started following Gonzalez when he went to Atlanta because I'd keep drafting him on my fantasy football teams as the old Mr. Reliable.
Yeah, fun fact, I met his mom, too, in a restaurant in San Francisco.
Very fun fact.
When I was there for the Super Bowl. And we, like, she'd have a shirt, like, saying, like, Tony Gonzalez's mom on it.
Oh, cool.
And, me and my brother and dad started talking to her. It's like, what are you doing here? Not in, like, that tone. Like, man, what are you doing here?
What are you doing here?
Yeah, you chat next to the person sitting next to you. She goes, my son's, here, because I think he had joined Fox by that point.
Okay.
She's there for broadcast. Like, my son's here. She's like, oh, it's your son. I was like, Tony Gonzalez. Huh.
Oh, shit.
He was pretty good.
Yeah, no, he was really good. Obviously, first ballot Hall of Famer. I like him even more that he started a fight with Chiefs fans.
I'd say... keep it going.
I mean, the equivalent there is almost like if Peyton Manning started shit with Colts fans.
Yeah, you know, really.
Like he played the majority of his career there and then went somewhere else and had, a lot of success for 4 or 5 years. So,
which is kind of like what he's done without saying it. He'd never publicly say anything bad about either of the franchises he played with.
Right.
But I think you can get the sense that, like, he takes the Broncos more seriously as an organization than the Colts, which is something that John Elway did too. But probably not the first one, whatever. The point is that Champ Bailey made it in. Well-deserved. Pat Bowlen also, long overdue. But it's nice to see them in eventually. So, we're – the first time we've had two guys go in the same year. And then who do you think the next guy to get in will be? If not, let's say cross Steve Atwater off that list. Not because he doesn't have a chance of getting in, but like who's the next guy that maybe retired recently or is still playing that you think will make it to the Hall of Fame?
Yeah, because I think the next guy is Steve Atwater. Whew, that's a good question. I mean, Peyton Manning.
Yeah, I guess that's a good point. I didn't think about that.
Probably Peyton. Because from like the Broncos Super Bowl years, you've got Sharp in, you've got Elway in, they've got Zimmerman in.
It feels like outside of Atwater, that, well has run dry.
Yeah, I mean, Rod Smith is an interesting player, I think.
Well, Rod Smith, is funny enough, like he's actually come up a little bit recently just because of people debating whether or not Julian Edelman is a Hall of Famer, which is a very, very dumb discussion. A guy who's got 30 – and I know, like he just won Super Bowl MVP and he's won 3 Super Bowls. Cool. A guy with 30 touchdowns and like no 1,000-yard – seasons, no all pros, no Pro Bowls. It's a little ridiculous to say that he gets in while guys like Isaac Bruce, who's like top 5 in all-time receiving yards, and Rod Smith, who, won 2 Super Bowls in Denver, has 68 career touchdowns, a couple all pros, a bunch of Pro Bowls. He probably should be in because Michael Irvin's in with very, very similar numbers. But I don't. He was too low profile, I think, to get in at this point, at this late in the game.
Yeah, it's I think he's the closest player you could debate that, maybe should be in. I don't know. With Champ going in, the thing that was nice was like looking back at old Champ Bailey highlights because I kind of just like forgot how athletic he was. How fast, both how quick Champ Bailey was and how high he could fucking jump. Because he was like 6 foot tall, right? He's like 6 feet tall.
Yeah.
6'1", somewhere in there. But I felt like he could jump like he was like a 6'4" wide receiver. It was insane seeing some of like the athletic plays he would make. And you're like, oh, yeah. That's why he was so good. On top of like just understanding the game and being like a really smart corner, And the stat that you pointed out, his 10 catch season, he was only thrown the ball at, or his 10 interception season, they only threw to him 35 times. That's nuts.
Yeah, no, it's ridiculous. Yeah, no, obviously some of those picks came off of balls that were not intended to go to him. But Champ Bailey, I think, is the leader in the clubhouse for best makeup speed, and that's how he got a lot of his interceptions. A lot of makeup speed. The three waves that Bailey basically got interceptions were he's just in the right place at the right time, which applies to everybody. Makeup speed was ridiculous. He burned Ben Roethlisberger like that a couple of times. Just ridiculously acrobatic interceptions. And then there are plays where he would just run the route better than the wide receiver and catch the ball looking like it was the wide receiver.
Yeah.
And I'm thinking about like a couple in that 2006 season, he runs this slant against Arizona. By the way, I was looking at his career like game logs, and he must have had like a third of his interceptions against Arizona because the Redskins and the Cardinals used to play in the same division for some reason, and they used to play twice a year. And he would just come up with like – he had like a three-pick game against Arizona his rookie year. Like had a couple two-pick games, just like constantly get a pick against like Jake Plummer or whoever they're tossing out, like Josh McCown at quarterback. And had a two-pick game against Arizona in 2006. And there's this one play where Matt Leinart was the quarterback at the point. And Bailey just like runs the slant like a wide receiver. And it looks like Leinart's just like throwing it perfectly to him. And there's another one where like Matt Hasselbeck goes deep against the Broncos in 2006. And I don't remember who he was throwing to, but like Bailey like, catches it in the end zone in stride, like a wide receiver, and runs out of the back of the end zone. Like he just scored a touchdown.
That's pretty funny. Yeah, it just his athleticism is like, I think that's one of the things I remember quarterbacks talking about in terms of like facing him as a corner is his athleticism is off the charts and yep. That, yeah, sometimes he knows the route the receiver's running and it's just like no reason to even throw in that direction because he knows what the other team's doing. And I think that's kind of like the similar reason, like Aqib Talib had a lot of success through his career is understanding, you know, how opposing quarterbacks play and how his opponents play and kind of just knowing those situations, but it wasn't enough for him to help the Rams win a Super Bowl. So
yes,
and Champ Bailey never got a Super Bowl ring either, which is unfortunate.
Yeah, that was very disappointing. They should give him an honorary one for 2015, but I think Champ is such a man of high integrity that he wouldn't accept it. Although he probably coached, you know, he's probably 25% of the reason Chris Harris is Chris Harris today.
We'll go with that.
We'll say, yeah, you know,
Chris Harris said, Wes Welker was harder to cover, but he was younger then. Julian Edelman is stronger, and catches the ball better in terms of comparing Wes Welker to Julian Edelman.
Interesting. Welker will make it into the Hall of Fame. Don't think Edelman should. But yeah,
that's because Welker had like
play for the Patriots.
He had all those those 130 yeah. catch seasons.
I know. Yeah, and he was an all pro in New England like three times probably. But yeah, he basically invented that position.
Yeah, the slot. Like
the white slot wide. Well, all due respect to Brandon Stokely first, but
that's true.
Yeah, basically the original slot machine. Speaking of the Hall of Fame, though, the Broncos are likely to play in the Hall of Fame game on August 1st against either the aforementioned Kansas City Chiefs or the Atlanta Falcons. I like this not because I think it matters or I care, but it's just nice to, like, you know, after a long, long summer, to get one extra Broncos game that 80% of the people on the field probably won't be playing in week one. But it's just nice, you know, if you get like a young quarterback, it's always exciting to see him go like 2 for 7 for, you know, 17 yards and then watch those highlights like over and over again, just waiting for the regular season to start. I'm excited. Hopefully it's against the Falcons rather than the Chiefs, because if it was against the Chiefs, you know, it'd be like run up the middle slant. You know, there'd be like three plays because no team would, you know, want to give up anything from their playbook to the other team.
Yeah, it'd be weird to play a division opponent. The first thing I thought about when I heard they are probably playing the Hall of Fame game was like, oh, good. That's one extra game I have to cover next season. The fucking video I have to make and pay attention to.
That's a good point.
And it's in the preseason. Yeah. Thank you.
Yeah, and it's going to be back-to-back with two Broncos Hall of Fame speeches.
Yeah. It's going to be a busy weekend next August.
But I think it's fair to, you know, put in a team with the most Hall of Famers from that class.
No, it totally makes sense. It makes sense. It was nice that Bolin finally got in. That felt like a foregone conclusion.
Yes.
I was a little surprised Steve Atwater didn't make it. And I bet you were very surprised that Ed Reed was there, Will. But you were really surprised.
I don't really have an excuse for that
one. Since when I asked you last week, you said no.
I think we all get it.
Okay. Yeah.
Let me explain myself. I confused his retirement with Troy Polamalu's retirement, which I think is fair because it came a year after. So just drop it, Brandon. Just drop it. Just forget about it.
Man, Ed Reed was so good. Ed Reed was – he was so good.
He was good.
He was so good. And out of all the Hall of Fame guys, he looks the coolest. Like Ed Reed right now with that like gray beard he's got and the hat he wears, like he just looks like a badass. Like I wish
– Yeah, like he's like, anywhere from like 35 to 85 years old.
Yeah.
It's like you can't pinpoint – anywhere close to how old he is just by looking at him.
No.
Ed Reed. Let's see. Zach Taylor, who was just brought in by the Cincinnati Bengals to be their first head coach in 100 years, first new head coach in 100 years. A little I don't want to say like Cincinnati fans are feeling buyer's remorse because I don't think you can pin that on one game. But – everybody who hired a Sean McVay clone, especially reaching as far as the quarterback coach on the Rams, not like, you know, Matt LaFleur is a little bit different because he's been a lot of places and he was more than just, you know, the Rams offensive coordinator 2 years ago. But Zach Taylor really was, you know, just the quarterback's coach for the Rams. And now a day after his offense – puts up 3 points. I say his offense like it's all his, but, you know, the offense he was working on puts up 3 points in the Super Bowl. He takes over a team. A little dicey of a situation. I think the Dolphins are feeling a little bit better with Brian Flores because on the flip side, he calls the plays for a defense that just allowed 3 points to, you know, arguably the best offense this season.
I would argue that's – the Patriots defense in the playoffs is the best Patriots defense they've had. And I thought, and I've always thought that their defenses in the postseason have been underrated, but their first Super Bowl wins in the early 2000s, they were a defensive like dominant team. But I think this defensive playoff run through those three games was one of the best I've seen them put together. So, yeah, if you're the Dolphins and you've got Brian Flores coming in after what you just witnessed, like you do feel like you made the right decision there. And I think the criticism towards Sean McVay has been blown probably way out of proportion. Hiring the head coach, though, you have to wonder, like, the reason Sean McVay got that job in L.A. was because he blew away everybody in his interview. They weren't going into that thinking like they were gonna definitely hire Sean McVay.
We're gonna hire the first Sean McVay.
Right. Like they came out of it being like, holy shit, this dude is special. So like the Bengals, like did Zach Taylor blow them away? I mean, he obviously didn't do it to the Broncos, so
right.
I think that will be a highly scrutinized sort of decision if he doesn't have success and if he doesn't have it quickly. And now you're looking at the Broncos going defensive-minded head coach, and you have to feel better about that. And I think what maybe gets lost with New England is, like, Bill Belichick is a defensive guy, and he just found, one, a great quarterback to run offense, and, you know, Josh McDaniels, who's probably, you know, over the last decade been consistently the best offensive coordinator in the league. So maybe, hopefully, that's kind of what – you hope the Broncos are able to put together with Fangio and, you know, going with your young smart guy as your OC, as opposed to a really young guy who hasn't had a lot of leadership position in the NFL, now having to lead an entire team. Like, that's where the risk is there for the Bengals.
Yeah, it feels like it's as much of a stretch on the, you know, just like taking care of like all the responsibilities that a coach has, because I think we lose track of like how much a coach has to oversee. And I think Hard Knocks last year with Hugh Jackson kind of illustrated how tumultuous that can get at times. And then just like having, you know, having to be the guy that, you know, speaks in front of 53, 22 to, you know, 36-year-old players. Yeah. And not being that much older, and like having to be the voice of authority with all those guys, and having to, you know, punish guys who don't make it back for curfew or break rules, or just kind of be like the disciplinarian around there. And obviously the Bengals have had problems with that under Marvin Lewis too. So it's a stretch. It's dicey. I don't know if, you know, the ceiling is not like a Sean McVay ceiling where he comes in and he's just an offensive mastermind and you're kind of written into the playoffs every year. It's like, if you're the Bengals, like, you're happy to get, like, you know, half of that with Zach Taylor.
Yeah. If you're the Bengals, you're happy to be 8-8 again every year.
Yeah. But, you know, on the flip side, you could have Hugh Jackson or Vance Joseph as your head coach too. So,
yeah. I don't even know why they would, like, do they just do a courtesy and interview Hugh Jackson as their head coach?
I think they really like value guys that come from within the organization.
Yeah, it's crazy.
They're kind of the Bengals are like almost the NFL equivalent of a cult, and the leader is Mike Brown. And like the chief tenet of that cult is just like saving money. And like the Bengals kind of just do whatever they can to like promote from within and like keep guys on their contracts as long as they can, not giving people new contracts when it's cheaper to draft guys. But it looks like they're kind of breaking that mold a little bit, at least with the Zach Taylor hire. Who knows? I'm not really privy to any of the details of the contract or anything. But, you know, we have to give him a chance, even though his team royally, royally sucked on Sunday.
Yeah, the Rams offense was pathetic, and I mean there's multiple reasons for that, but I think the biggest one is, you know, I think Jared Goff just was not ready for the moment, and I don't know.
Oh yeah, yeah.
I don't even know how good of a quarterback Jared Goff really is. We've seen him. We saw this last season. We saw him play really great football, and then I saw him play like pretty average football. But his team still dominated just because it was a really good team. And I think like his fourth quarter interception and some other things we can talk about. Yeah, we might as well just start talking about the fucking Super Bowl.
Yeah. Well, yeah. On that point too, like Goff was a really strange case this season because, obviously, we gave him a lot of benefit of the doubt after coming back from a really terrible rookie season where guys kind of just wrote him off as being a bust, and then he comes in with a new head coach, and then we shift all of the blame to Jeff Fisher because that's what we like to do. We like to pin 100% of the blame on one person because that's always how it works. Has a pretty competent, you know, second season. And then comes into his third season and early on is lighting it up. you know, early on when the Rams are still undefeated, they're running Todd Gurley, obviously, which is, you know, the main engine behind the offense, and they have an improved offensive line, and they get Brandon Cooks in there. And then there's that Thursday night game really early in the season where Jared Goff has the best game of his career. Right. And the Goff stock is at an all-time high, and it's really never reached that peak again. And it's just kind of slowly, you know, obviously he had a lot to do with winning that NFC championship game. He, you know, almost won it by himself, you could say. A little bit of help, of course. But it's kind of reached to that point again where the discussion almost comes up is like, well, if Sean McVay is that valuable and the system is that valuable, and the system is the reason why that offense goes, and you've already locked up Todd Gurley, you could lock up Brandon Cooks or whoever you want. Is it feasible to say, all right, Jared Goff worked well within the system, but rather than paying him $35 million a season after his rookie contract expires, draft a new quarterback if the idea is that, well, anyone can operate from a high level within that good of a system? And maybe not everyone, but, you know, any competent quarterback.
Yeah, I mean, maybe. Maybe it provides you that flexibility. Because, I mean, what it looked like in the Super Bowl is that the Rams just were going to run whatever play was called, essentially, right? And maybe Goff has one play to check down to if they don't like the read, but he's not at a position yet where I feel like he's dictating anything at the line of scrimmage. And maybe I'm wrong, but it just, to me, watching him in that game was, one, he wasn't dictating, but two, like, he was also missing reads for open players. And I think part of that was that the Rams had success so much this season with, like, taking the deep ball and going, throwing to guys who, kind of like the way the Patriots get all the time, like, guys get very open consistently, I feel like, in that offense. But he had pressure. The Patriots defense put more pressure on him than I think he was used to, because that offensive line had been so good this season. I think it was the first playoff game they played. When they played against Dallas, like, Goff had like all day to throw. I felt like every time he dropped back, he could just sit there and find his guy. And when that goes away, you really find out like what your quarterback is made of. And I just kept thinking, you know, if Drew Brees was in this game, he would be having some success against the Patriots defense, even though it's playing really well. And you have to imagine that Mark Ingram and Alvin Kamara would have had more success than C.J. Anderson and Todd Gurley ended up having. The way they used Todd Gurley was weird. I really don't know what was going on with his knee. But the thing that I took away that Tony Romo said with the Patriots defense, because the Rams offense runs that sort of the zone blocking scheme, right? The one cutback. Yeah. And Belichick coached his players to just go through the gaps. Don't follow with the blocks. And that like ended their run game, and Goff couldn't open that back up for them through passing.
Yeah, he might have just broken the Shanahan offense. Like, it'll just never it's like that.
Yeah.
All right, guys, we figured it out. Just run through the gaps.
Just run through the gap and then, you know, disturb stuff there. And the other thing, I think my biggest takeaway was that the Rams don't have a big receiver to help out a guy like Goff.
Yeah.
Like, Brandon Cooks was not coming down with those jump balls. He could have had two contested touchdown catches like we talked about in the recap episode. And I don't know if Cooper Kupp's would have been that guy either, but a big Julio Jones type receiver could have been the difference for Jared Goff, because it looks like he needs a receiver he can throw to regardless of he's covered, like fucking Brady has with Gronkowski. You know what I mean?
Yeah. And they don't have a huge like playmaking tight end either.
No, a tight end catch a pass in that game from the Rams?
Yeah, I mean, if they did, it wasn't anything significant.
So, I was expecting the Rams to come out of halftime having some more success.
They didn't.
And I also saw a thing that said that the Patriots defense was in a man defense 67% of the time this season, which they ran it more than anybody else. And then this game, they ran 90% zone.
Yeah. Aside from Stephon Gilmore, who they said, all right, we'll let you stay on your side of the field and cover your guy man to man. And obviously that's like one of the big reasons, like he probably should have gotten better consideration for MVP.
Right.
Along with the interception. But yeah, no, they switched to 90% zone. And like the Rams just couldn't adjust to that curveball the whole game. Like even with the long halftime, like they couldn't figure out a plan to break that. And I think I was actually reading a little bit before we started recording. Warren Sharp on Twitter has a really interesting thread about the Super Bowl that everyone listening should go click on. But he was basically saying that the Rams, to eliminate the Patriots pass rush, which I think we can all agree was, one of the big reasons too that we haven't mentioned, that the Patriots defense overall had so much success. You know, the way to combat that too was to go with 12 personnel, which is one running back, two tight ends, and then have both tight ends blocking, pass blocking. And the three times they did that, Goff hit a 16-yard pass, I think, in a 14-yard pass. And then the other time they did that was that Cooks throw in the middle of the end zone that where he's wide open.
Oh, right.
But Goff, for whatever reason, like he kind of just floated it instead of, I haven't seen that play from a different angle yet, but it feels like if he had thrown a flatter ball, like a line drive, that's probably a touchdown.
Yeah, that ball definitely floated and was like kind of wobbly. Yeah, that's right. Interesting. And I think like that goes to kind of back up the point about Jared Goff is very good when he has time to throw the football.
Mm-hmm.
But it's like when he got disturbed in this game, and I'm sure throughout the season he's had pressure and probably one of those fucking quarterbacks that's like, oh, under pressure, he was one of the best. Like, but for whatever reason in this game, like it wasn't working. And those –
right.
Like, as smart as Sean McVay is, like, that's the type of thing you expect him to notice during a game and be like, okay, let's keep that type of personnel in here until it doesn't work. And maybe they did notice, but like, some of those passes I think were happening in the fourth quarter. Maybe it was just too late for them to,
right,
be effective with it, but.
Yeah, no, it feels like it would have helped out, too, on that throw to Cooks. And maybe they don't have that play available with two tight ends. But obviously, like, on that interception by Gilmore, they keep in, I think it was Todd Gurley, not C.J. Anderson, but Gurley to his right. But they just have two free rushers on the right side, and Gurley has to basically pick.
Yeah, he had to pick one.
The guy gets in Goff's face, which obviously affects the throw, and Gilmore – like we said in the video, like could have just called fair catch essentially and taken it at the five. Like he said, the easiest interception he had all season.
Yeah, it was the Patriots just they looked more prepared.
Not offensively, defense, yeah. I mean, yeah.
The Rams' defense, I thought, was they played better than I expected. Wade Phillips might have called his best game as a defense coordinator. And it was wasted, like holding New England to 3 points for most of the game. Like, I feel like this. Here's the question: the Saints. I don't think their defense would have played that well, but I know they would have scored more than 3 points. Yeah. And I feel like the Saints on a bad day would have scored 17 or 20 points in that game, at the minimum. So. It's like, would the Saints have won that game being in there? Or would they have lost regardless because their defense wouldn't have done what the Rams defense did? And I say that knowing that the Saints had a pretty damn good defense throughout the entire season.
Yeah, I mean, it's hard to say. I mean, all you can say really with any sort of confidence is that it would have been a more entertaining game.
Yeah, I think the NFL rule with the penalty, it should have been that Drew Brees got to play in the Super Bowl, but with the Rams.
Yes. No, I think that's perfect.
Because he could have. Yeah. Like.
Yeah, yeah. And you have to replace, like, Robey Coleman for, I don't know, like, P.J. Williams on the Saints. Who, but, yeah, I mean, I don't want to turn this into, like, a fuck the Patriots. The Rams got hosed by the officials. But that that first quarter penalty against Nickell Robey Coleman for tackling Rex Burkhead, it kind of set the tone a little bit.
Yeah, and, like, I think the Patriots didn't even score on that drive.
No, but that's a big penalty on the, like, in a field position game.
Yeah, that's what I was going to say is if – I think that would have put them in a third and very long. So if the Rams stop them there and get good field position, which was something they really did not have hardly at all in that game, you know, that could have been a field goal. It could have been a lot of things. The Patriots punter too, he had a hell of a game. Ryan Allen. Like, both punters played pretty well, but he pinned that ball within the 10. How many times? Like, 3 or 4 times? Like,
yeah, I think so. Him and Slater, basically.
I kept waiting for a special teams mistake to happen, and it didn't. Gostowski misses a 46-yarder, and, you know, Greg the Leg misses in the fourth quarter, but
yeah, the game was kind of out of reach.
I was waiting for a bad punt, a punt return, a muff punt, but I mean that's part of the reason the game was so boring is the special teams played perfect, the defense has played perfect,
right?
The Patriots offense did just enough to eke out a win.
Yeah, which I guess that'll lead me to the next point, which is in a game where the defense was the story. And Stephon Gilmore, I would have said if the Rams, the way that game was playing out, if the Rams had won, I think the MVP probably should have been Corey Littleton. And then I think, you know, there's a really good argument to be made for a couple of Patriots defenders. Like, I think you could have given it to Dante Hightower, or I think you could have given it to Stephon Gilmore. I think the easier pick would be Stephon Gilmore, just because he had the game-sealing interception. But obviously, Edelman has the stats, and when we're thinking about MVP in the Super Bowl, we're immediately drawn first, like, how did the quarterback play? Well, quarterback played pretty shitty. He had 13 points in total, so probably not right to give it to him. And, like, all right, anybody else on offense? No, not really. I mean, Sony Michel had one touchdown from 2 yards, but that play was more like the result of James Devlin bulldozing the defense out of the way.
Right.
All right. Julian Edelman had 10 catches for 141 yards, and it didn't really feel like they led to anything because it didn't make a difference on that. You know, it set him up for a couple field goals, but it didn't make a difference on the touchdown drive. That was mostly Gronkowski. It didn't set him up for that game-sealing field goal by Gostowski. It felt like a little bit of filler, just like something to do while, you know, no scores were happening. It didn't really feel like it affected the game. You go. The only argument, like, is he affected the time of possession in the Patriots' favor.
Yeah,
which I don't know if that's worth MVP.
I think really it comes down to, like, he's like the only guy you can remember making plays on offense throughout the game. And none of them were spectacular. It's like, oh, you got 9 yards on a 3rd and 7. You got 13 on a 2nd and 5. Like, he was just the guy you remembered catching balls in the game because so little offense was happening both ways.
Right. And I think what we need to do is stop thinking about MVP in terms of who has the best numbers and think of, like, who affected the game the most and who actually, you know, caused their team to win more than anybody else.
Yeah. And I mean, if, like,
think about it that way, it's, you know, completely different.
Yeah. Stephon Gilmore, I think, is huge because the Rams weren't able to throw the ball really at all in that game. He had the pick. He popped the ball out of CJ Anderson's hand, caused, like, the, you know, the one fumble that went out of bounds.
Right. I think if a Patriot picks that up, I think Stephon Gilmore actually does win MVP.
Yeah. No, you're probably right. Like,
yeah, they set him up for a touchdown.
Yeah.
Maybe the interception doesn't even happen at that point, though, if they score there. But
yeah, because on the interception he got, who was in on the blitz? Was that Hightower blitzing there, or
I don't remember.
I
can't really say one way or another.
Because whoever blitzed there was just as effective as, you know, him making
right. Yeah,
picks were just a terrible throw. You know what the shitty thing too is? Yeah. Like, if Goff has like a stronger arm, you know, if he's like a Pat Mahomes or an Aaron Rodgers, mm-hmm. where they can be on their back foot and still sling it 50 yards. Like, I think in that situation, even with the pressure, they throw it deep and outside where Cooks right. actually has a chance to maybe even catch it in that situation, because it looked like he had a half step on Gilmore, but it's an underthrown ball because, you know, Jared Goff isn't, you don't think of him as having this crazy arm talent. The other thing that's interesting, so that was a bad pass by Goff. And if you go back to the Chiefs game where Mahomes had the running back wide open,
yeah.
and he just overthrows him. It's like, those are young quarterbacks just, you know, letting, I think, nerves get to him in a big game and not doing the right thing. Like, watching both of those guys play so well throughout the season and then see him make mistakes like that in the postseason, just, it goes to remind you, like, it's hard on that stage to be perfect, to be really good. And
it is too. Like, and I thought Goff played like nails in the NFC Championship game in a tougher yeah. environment. I just don't think he could unlock whatever the Patriots were doing on offense that was stumping them. And a little bit goes to the head coach too. Like, he couldn't, and obviously Sean McVay took all the blame, which a good leader does, but little ricochet shot to Sean Payton there, because that's what a good leader does. But they couldn't, you know, it comes down to they couldn't make adjustments and they couldn't figure it out in a game where one drive at any point in the game would have made the difference. And there's that, and there's the fact that Todd Gurley disappeared for one reason or another. There were spurts in the game where it looked like he was, you know, fine. And then he kind of came out, and then
and his best play gets called back for a no hold.
Right, yeah, for a phantom hold. That was pretty disappointing. It's just like they can never get a rhythm.
No,
they could never get a rhythm offensively. They couldn't string any positive plays together. And it's just, you know.
It's funny how a zone defense is really hard for young quarterbacks to handle.
It is. It is because it's a lot of anticipation.
Yeah.
And knowing the soft spots in the zones and knowing where guys are going to pick up their receivers.
Because once you're a vet, you prefer that opposing defense run zone because you're going to know where the spots are to throw every time. And it's like Peyton Manning used to do it. Tom Brady, if you play – like, that's what I didn't understand about the Chiefs and the Chargers using so much zone against him. He will destroy you. It's – but
right.
until you know what the defense is doing all the time, you're going to make mistakes against zone defenses. I lost my train of thought. Oh yeah. The big thing, you know, they're talking about early in the game is how Wade Phillips was making sure Brady was confused pre-snap as to whether they would be in zone or man. So, I wish I knew more about football to really like be able to understand, you know, a game like this, like why was it won or lost on one side of the ball, the other? Because you can look at all the easy things, you know, a lot of what we talked about, but it would be cool to have the knowledge to be able to point out the little things like, oh, in the third quarter, or this player made this slight mistake that you wouldn't have noticed, but that cost him 12 yards. I don't know. I just wish I was smarter is what I'm saying.
It's generally not that hard to figure out whether the defense is going to be playing man or zone before you snap the ball. Because A, you can motion a receiver, and if the defender follows the receiver, that means they're in man. And then B, like, you can tell usually by the way they're set up, like if they're close to the line of scrimmage and they're close to the wide receiver and their hips are square towards the wide receiver, that means it's man coverage. And if they're backed off and their hips are pointed more towards the sideline, that usually means zone.
Right.
But it's not really a matter of, like, you know, deciphering what coverage they're in terms of man versus zone. It's a matter of finding out, like, where do you throw the ball and, like, where's the blitz coming from too.
Yeah, I don't know. I feel like if I was a NFL defensive coordinator, I would find a slot corner who I can move around and have them be physical at the line of scrimmage with most anybody. There's always going to be exceptions. Like, you're not going to put a guy on Gronk and try to manhandle him at the line of scrimmage. But I feel like all you got to do to take Julian Edelman out of a game is disrupt his timing with Brady. And even the Rams didn't do like a great job. I saw Marcus Peters play up on him and just get like turned around at the line of scrimmage. I saw Coleman get burnt. Like, I don't know why you wouldn't like try to teach hand fighting basically at the line of scrimmage to all your corners and or safeties. Even if you just have one or two guys to do that on specific matchups, because you're not going to need it to happen with every player. But for Julian Edelman specifically with the Patriots, you throw that, disrupt that timing, it really limits what Brady likes to do on that offense.
Yeah. And the thing is, like, the Patriots have a lot of versatility on offense, and there wasn't like a clear matchup for like a lot of guys on the Rams defense. Like Talib, you're always thinking, well, he's going to cover like the number one big bodied wide receiver. And the Patriots don't have that. So you're putting Talib on the Patriots' de facto wide receiver, number one wide receiver, and that's Edelman. And that's not really a matchup that's in Talib's favor, because Edelman's quicker. He gets in and out of cuts quick. Like, and he's not going to be like fighting at the point of attack for the ball with Talib. He's going to be getting separation inside and outside.
Now, Talib was on Edelman early, right? Like, the first two big passes Edelman caught were, I think, Talib, and I think they switched it. I thought Marcus Peters actually played a pretty good game.
I did too, yeah.
Because they targeted him quite a bit.
Mm-hmm.
But
yeah, they took shots against him. I don't think he was falling for the double moves, though.
No, because there's a lot of third and kind of longs, and they took shots where he was in coverage and he made a play. So the Rams defense was great. Defensive line maybe could have been a little better, but it came down to like the Patriots defensive line both was more physical than the Rams offensive line. And it's like they brought schemes and blitzes that the Rams offensive line just got confused and didn't pick up correctly. And that was probably like the real difference maker in that game.
Yeah, and it like for a while it felt like the Rams were just getting beat on the offensive line every play.
Yeah.
And Austin Blythe, who I think is the right guard, was just getting manhandled pretty consistently, and it's just hard to win on offense when you're getting pushed back 2 yards every time you snap the ball.
Yeah. And it's the strength on their line is their tackles, and
they're
blocking as they're, you know, running out towards the sideline and pushing the defense one way or the other. And Patriots is like, no, they have weakness inside and we can beat those matchups physically and disrupt that whole system they have. It was interesting.
Right.
It was like the shit we're talking about, you can just realize that nothing really that exciting happened in the game.
I know. Yeah. It's like, we got to find something to pick apart about this game, because it was just a whole lot of nothing.
Dude, it was the easiest like highlights where I had to just find shit.
In terms
of, like, I know there's hardly anything there.
Yeah. It's like compared to the last Super Bowl, like you had so many plays that you had to put together. And this was like, you know, you can count on one hand.
I was like, oh yeah, the Rams. It was that big run by Todd Gurley that got called back, and the Patriots was that big pass to Gronk that got him on the 2 or 3 yard line, and even that was like a 24-5 yard pass or some shit.
Right. Yeah. Like it's pretty standard
offensive plays.
Happens in every Patriots game. It felt like I was, you know, convinced that it was going to be like a classic Patriots Super Bowl where, you know, there's not a lot of scoring for like 25 minutes. And then there's just like an outburst of scoring all of a sudden.
I was expecting that to happen. I thought the second half was going to.
Yeah. And gonna see that never happened. And that was the worst part of it, I think.
Yeah, it was interesting. I like personally, I was fine with it because I was like, Brady's not doing anything. Like, I don't care. I like watching the defense not let the Pats do anything. Obviously, I wanted to see the Rams offense do something. They just didn't – they couldn't get it going.
Yeah, so what do you think this does to – A, like everybody says, like, you know, after a team loses the Super Bowl for the most part you know, no one really said it after the Broncos. It's kind of funny. It's ironic because no one said, you know, after the Broncos lost the Super Bowl, you're like, well, they'll be back anyway. Like, they're young, like, they're talented, they'll be back. And, of course, they are, like, the one team that comes back from losing the Super Bowl in the last, like, 10 years and actually comes back to win it. Whereas, like, teams with, you know, the Panthers, the 2015 Panthers go 15-1. They make it to the Super Bowl. They lose by 2 touchdowns, but everybody goes, well, you know, they'll be back. Of course they'll be back. It's like, that's not how it works. Like, people don't hand out Super Bowls. Like, you're there. Like, you can't count on anything else aside from you're guaranteed 60 minutes then. Yeah. And then after that, anything can happen. You might have a losing record, you know, next year, like the Panthers, despite going 15-1 the year before. It's just like nothing, you know, nothing can be guaranteed. Like, I saw a lot of people saying, like, Sean McVay, well, he's 33. He'd coach for, you know, 3 or 4 more decades. That doesn't guarantee anything about him coming back to a Super Bowl. Like, it could just be that, you know, especially with a team like the Rams, that you felt like they went all out on this season to win this Super Bowl. And they signed Ndamukong Suh and Brandon Cooks and guys on one-year deals or older guys like Tlaib, and they get Peters. And they're all in, and they're trying to cash their chips right now, and it doesn't work out. And all of a sudden, well, they don't have a lot of draft picks coming up, and they're going to have to pick Goff, and, you know, Sue is going to walk in free agency. And maybe, who knows, like, McVay's the talent evaluator that can restock in pretty short order. But I don't know that, you know, they're penciled in to a Super Bowl appearance within the next like 3 or 4 years again.
Yeah. I mean, what they do this off season is going to be really interesting. I think Marcus Peters and Aqib Tlaib are on. Yeah. They both are under contract, but they're both in the final year, so I believe like the Rams could move on from either of those guys if they wanted to. Their top paid players are Aaron Donald, Andrew Whitworth.
Whitworth Michael Brockers.
It'll be interesting to see what they do moving forward because they did go all in for this year. That was clear before the season started. How they manage the cap situation and limited draft picks. I'll be curious. Like, I think they'll be good next year, but there's nothing about them that says they're going to be better than they were this year.
Right. And that's a team that barely made the Super Bowl.
Yeah. I thought the Eagles had a chance to be equally as good this last season because they were going to have a lot of their key pieces. You know, they moved some guys around, but for the most part, the core was still there. But, you know, they struggled throughout the season, got lucky to get in the playoffs. So you're right. There's no guarantee unless you're the stupid Patriots. The Broncos, it was different because I think they had Peyton Manning at the time. That's why everybody expected them to be back.
And a lot of guys that, you know, won the Super Bowl in the last year, their rookie contracts like Trevathan and Malik Jackson, that could just say like, well, we won the Super Bowl. I'm going to go get paid now.
Yeah. The other thing the Broncos had after the Seahawks loss was a bunch of their players were hurt and not in that game at least on the defensive side of the ball. So
yeah, they're guys like Von Miller and Chris Harris and like Ryan and, you know, Derek Wolf, who are like, we've never played in a Super Bowl. Like, we were there physically, but
yeah,
like CJ Anderson, who's like, you know, tactically suited up, like,
yeah,
they're still hungry for, you know, they're hungry to get back after that. Like, they weren't resigned at any point. And the guys that maybe were resigned, like, you know, Knowshon Moreno or Eric Decker or Monte Ball, like, they – or Julius Thomas, they got out of there quick.
Right.
And so it did feel like a fairly new team.
You know what? I saw the stat about Brandon Cooks is going to make $27.5 million next season.
Yeah.
And Julian Edelman hasn't made $27.5 million in his career with the Patriots.
Of course.
That's like, that is another reason why the Patriots, I believe, are successful every single year, is because
they pay their players under the table.
Yeah. They find guys who are willing to play for less than they're worth. You know what I mean?
Like, yeah.
Tom Brady could have asked for, you know, max QB deal at any point over the last 5 years or whatever. You got Julian Edelman there, who's a key to their offense, whose entire career just played for less money than the value he's brought to that team.
I don't know. Like, I don't know if he is the key to their offense. Like, they play.
I'm not saying he's the key, but he's a big part of it.
Right. I'm just saying, like, they scored 33 points in the Super Bowl last year without him.
Yeah.
Without him or Brandon Cooks, for the most part.
Well, that's fair. But
it's like, that's the reason, you know, they don't have to pay those guys, is because they know, the guys on that offense know that they're replaceable, and like, they'd prefer to have those guys, but
they find the guys who,
if the price is too high,
are okay to be underpaid because they know they have the best chance of winning it.
Same goes for Jamie Collins.
Oh, well,
yeah,
it's over.
It's over. We're done with it.
Their stupid parade's over. Their fans can keep beating the shit out of themselves on Twitter. And,
AAF is about to start.
Oh, yeah. We're going to work on telling you who you can root for in the Alliance, American Alliance Football, whatever the fuck it's called.
I think it's the Alliance of American Football.
Alliance of American Football.
Yeah.
I think, and Will doesn't even know this yet, but we are going to take next week off the podcast. For sure. Maybe the next 2 weeks. I don't know yet.
Oh, boy.
Need a break, at least a week break. So there's that. And this episode's going up early. So
that's right.
Double surprise.
Not a surprise for me. Last piece of news, really quickly. The Raiders of Oakland, possibly of San Francisco, eventually of Las Vegas. They're close to playing at Oracle Stadium, formerly AT&T Stadium. It's the home of the San Francisco Giants, whatever you want to call it. The Raiders just need that infield. They need that dirt infield, don't they?
They need that, yeah. They need that dirt infield to underachieve.
It's the strangest thing, because they're going to go from playing in the worst venue in sports, I think without a doubt. Maybe you could make a case for, like, I don't know, Tropicana Field in Tampa Bay. But they're going to go from probably the worst to maybe the nicest venue in all of sports. And it just doesn't feel like they belong there.
Didn't the San Francisco mayor say he doesn't support them playing in San Francisco?
I wouldn't be surprised. I'm sure the Giants don't like it. It's weird. It's just weird, because I've been to that stadium a ton of times to see the Rockies play. And just other, you know, various Giants games. And that's, you know, it's the nicest stadium in baseball. It's right on the water. Obviously, you have the Cove right behind it. It's within walking distance of a lot of really nice San Francisco attractions. It's a perfect place to play baseball. I'm sure it'd be a perfect place to play football if they did. They used to play some college bowl games there. I think Nevada and Boston College played back in 2010. But yeah, it's strange. It's just very weird. And you wonder why, like, if they couldn't get a deal done with the 49ers, how are they going to get a deal done with the Giants?
Yeah, I feel like if the Raiders play there, it's almost like a mean trick to play on the Raiders fans. who have shown up and rooted for him in that shithole for so long. And they're like, we could have had something nice like this, and now you're taking that nice thing and putting it in Las Vegas.
Yeah, it's also a very windy venue because it's like right on the water and there's nowhere. I can't think of any like football stadiums that are that close to the water, because literally like you can hit a home run and you know, there's the splash hits and everything like that. So it's not like it is like when people say it's on the water, it is on the water. And you
Alcatraz. It's on the island.
Yeah. You got your geography perfect. So yeah, no, it might not be very helpful to the passing game or the kicking game, but who knows? The Raiders make it work. They make it work. I don't think it's going to make a huge difference where they play. I don't think they're going to be all that good next season.
Yeah, it's just kind of funny that three of the four LA teams don't have a home stadium right now.
Yeah, no, it's bizarre.
It's displaced. The displaced NFL teams are all in California.
Right. That being said, I will probably try to buy a ticket to see the Broncos play there next year, because that'll be interesting.
Yeah, wherever it ends up. They should know by next week when we're not podcast.
Yeah.
All right. Well, I'm glad everybody listened to this thing. It was not fun at all to talk about the Patriots Super Bowl again, but we did it.
We made it. We made it. We're finally at the offseason, which I know we're all looking forward to.
We've got the Oscars.
Finally have stuff to talk about.
Yep, we got the Oscars, and then we've got free agency, you know?
That's right. And then we're going to unleash our mock draft 2.0,
hell yeah,
3.0, then our 4.0, and then eventually our 5.0.
You make enough, you're going to get some picks right.
Yeah. No, you just collect all the right picks
yep.
you know, together and then count that as one draft.
Called it.
Yep.
All right. Thanks for listening to That's Good Sports Podcast. Bye.